Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the closed for business sign is still up on many federal government offices, while the candidate for governor business is thriving in Massachusetts. We'll talk about all that and the state of the mayor's race right up front. Then, 70 years ago, there were 250 women's colleges. Now they're just 50, eight of them in New England. Is a single-sex school better for certain young women, or is it an artificial divide?
The Reverend Eugene Rivers joins us to address criticism that he's chastised his black neighbors for lackluster voting while not voting himself for decades. Then, are Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, Rachel Maddow, and MSNBC to blame for our vitriolic politics? And finally, Vern Locke's on the very best season for bird migration right now. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
And hello, Marjorie.
How are you?
So I'm fine,
good.
Thank you. The government is still shut down partially as the sides appear even farther apart. The final field for the 2014 gubernatorial election appears nearly set. Marjorie and I hope that the shutdown ends before we have a new governor. A Globe columnist says Scott Brown's 15 minutes of fame is over. And the mayoral race begins to take shape. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over all this and maybe a little bit more, our former state treasurer and Democratic gubernatorial nominee, Shannon O'Brien. Hello, Shannon.
Hello.
And Charlie Chipio served in the Romney administration as a policy director. He's now the principal of Chipio Strategies. Hey, Charlie.
Hi.
Good to see you both.
Thank you.
So
good to be here.
I'm getting a little nervous here that we may not resolve this whole logjam and we're facing this debt ceiling deal October 17th. Do you see a way out of this, Charlie Chipio?
Well, I don't see a way out of it, frankly. I'm sure there is a way out of it. I just don't see what it is because, I think we're dealing with crazy people. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm not one who's crazy about Obamacare, but it was passed. It was signed by the president. It was upheld by the Supreme Court. It's the law.
Yeah.
You
think Ted Cruz is a wacky bird, like John McCain calls him?
Yeah, out of his mind. Completely out of his mind.
Yeah, but before we go to Shannon on this, even though I understand the president's position has been we don't talk about Obamacare now. If you want to later propose making it better, that's fine. The medical device tax, which is one of the things that Boehner has put on the table, the speaker, let's get rid of this. A huge number of Democrats, including a huge number of Democratic congresspeople from Massachusetts, want to dump that. Why not throw that to the Republicans? They can go home and say they got something and settle this thing.
Well, sounds like a good recipe to me.
By the way, that's what Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, suggested the other day, who is
an
anti-Obamacare
person.
But she is wildly anti-shutdown.
Well, what's wrong with that?
See, I don't think that that's necessarily a bad idea, but the problem is I'm not sure that that even works. I mean, even the... I think that actually Speaker Boehner has on a number of different occasions tried to actually sit down and work with President Obama, you know, and he cannot take these people along. The problem is Tea Party members. I mean, Charlie, there are very few speaking out like Charlie does who are rational Republicans in Washington.
Nothing to lose.
I know. I know there's no
fun.
Well,
by the way, you know who won? Do you know who one of those rational people was? Mm-hmm. John Boehner himself said a few months ago, Obamacare is the settled law of the land. And he apparently went and struck a deal with a senator before this all happened.
Right.
Democratic senator saying, we'll do a continuing resolution at a reduced level of funding, which the Republicans wanted. The Democrats said yes, but apparently couldn't sell it.
The problem is Boehner just does not control his membership. And that is what is really what you should really be scared about is that there's nobody in charge on the other side. And so I think that it's difficult for Obama at this point in time. He may at the 11th or maybe 13th hour.
He being the president,
do something like that. But until that happens, then it becomes a game of more and more. What else can you give us?
Yeah, well, let's hear a little bit of John Boehner from ABC's this week when he kind of dashed a lot of people's hopes that there could be some easy way out of it. Let's hear him talking yesterday.
The House has passed four bills to keep the government open and to provide fairness to the American people under Obamacare. And even after the Senate has rejected, they've rejected all four of them. And even after the four rejections, we asked to sit down with the Senate and have a conversation. They said no.
And Boehner said that immediately after having responded to George Stephanopoulos's question. He says there's simply not the votes to pass a clean CR. And what that means in the English language is an appropriations bill that does not have some cutback on Obamacare. Well, Chuck Schumer, Democratic New York senator, responded to Boehner on This Week. Here's what he said.
Let me issue him a friendly challenge. Put it on the floor Monday or Tuesday. I would bet there are the votes to pass it. We have just about every Democrat. 21 Republicans have publicly said they would. There are many more Republicans who have said that they privately would. So, Speaker Boehner, just vote. Put it on the floor and let's see if you're right.
There's a great quote that if it were a secret ballot, 150 Republicans.
Yeah, you know who said that?
Right.
Peter King, a Republican,
right,
is the one who said that. Yeah.
But even if they weren't a secret ballot, there is a sense that they could get this so-called clean CR passed. So I guess you have to wonder whether Boehner, as we get closer and closer to October 17th, is going to want his legacy in the history books to be the guy that caused us to default. He doesn't seem to be that out there.
Well, it's got to be awful to be walking around saying stuff you don't mean. And, you know, and that's what he's been forced to do. And I think Shannon's right. This is not the first time this has happened. If you remember the debt ceiling debacle in the summer of 2011, he and Obama were able to come to an agreement. He couldn't sell it to the Tea Party.
Including raising taxes on people who made more than $1 million.
Right.
$1 million a year. But, you know, the reality is, even though everybody's blaming the Tea Party, I think it's fair to say they're the ones who are holding this up. They're duly elected by their people. They're doing the same sort of legislative maneuvering, I'm assuming, at least at this stage, that a small core of liberal Democrats would do if they felt that something was going in a direction they didn't like, Shannon O'Brien.
Yeah,
no?
Yeah, they're duly elected. But the problem is they're duly elected by increasingly more partisan and increasingly more worse gerrymandered
but
seats.
But that's not illegal.
No.
That's
it's
the
not,
nature of the
not
beast.
It's not illegal. But the fact is that in terms of the will of the people of the country. You know what I mean? You know, even though there are more Republicans in office in the House of Representatives, the Democrats got 1.3 million more votes than the Republicans did. So again, we don't have that kind of voting in this country. We don't have popular vote for Congress. But the fact is, as these local redistricting make these districts more partisan, makes these kind of crazier people more immune from
Shannon,
challenges,
Shannon.
And harms the smart, middle-of-the-road thinking Republicans. It's going to just be a path
Shannon,
to disaster for
when
the country.
When you were a Democratic legislator on Beacon Hill, did you ever vote on redistricting? Were you there? Okay, fine. Didn't you vote on a plan that I assume was crafted by a Democratic chair, which made it extremely unlikely that a Republican could beat a sitting Democrat?
You want to know something? There was redistricting that was done to help incumbent Republicans as well as incumbent Democrats. I can assure you of that.
Well, there weren't any. What year was that? What
incumbent? There were more.
What year was this?
when
was there incumbent Republican? Mid-90s. There was Torkelson.
There were a lot more Republicans I'm just. I'm talking about the local legislative seats as well as the congressional seats. The fact is.
Oh, you mean within the legislature?
Yeah, I thought you were talking about. Yeah, from my own seat. I thought you were talking about from my own seat. Yes.
But you know what's kind of scary was this story that the Times had, the Globe had it yesterday too. It was originally from the Times, of course. This group led by former Attorney General Edwin Meese got together, you know, months ago to try to plot this whole strategy, even giving Republicans talking points and how to answer questions about defunding the government and causing the United States to default on their bills, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it makes it seem like this is a very organized, disciplined,
just very purposefully getting
group
to this point.
Around the Affordable Care Act,
exactly.
We're talking about, right?
Yeah,
which I found amazing. And I also find, Ed Meese has got to be 115
That's
years
what
old.
I saw. <can't believe laughs> We should say former Attorney General
for Reagan.
For Reagan, right? Yeah. For Ronald Reagan. Yeah.
That shows a lot of forethought and planning on the part of these tea parties that wanted to fund Obamacare.
And probably one of the best symptoms of this concerted effort was seen on the Jimmy Kimmel show last week, where they had the man on the street asking people, do you support Obamacare? Overwhelmingly, they hated it. But in the same breath, they loved the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
So. And I don't really urge people to go online and waste any more time on YouTube than they already do. It's fascinating to watch that one piece.
And
we do urge people to go online and waste their time because that is one of the funniest things ever.
But
by the way, it's not just that. It's almost any – when you ask people about how they feel about big government legislation, they always hate it. And then when the next question is, do you support X, Y, and Z, which are the core
Medicare,
principles, they love the legislation. But in part, that's a function of failure to sell the policies.
Something else people shouldn't miss if they haven't seen it, was Saturday Night Live's rendition of John Boehner dancing with Michelle Bachmann. It was pretty outright.
I saw that.
Miley Cyrus playing Michelle Bachmann.
Oh,
yes,
my God.
Yes. The John Boehner character has multiple piercings and he's dancing in his underpants.
So I am doing an informal poll. Well, virtually every poll suggests that people in America love their own member of Congress and hate Congress. I mean, that's been going on forever, even when Congress is more popular. If there were a national referendum, which there can't be, but if there were a national referendum where you had to vote yes or no on should we replace all 535 members of Congress, which would include your beloved own congressperson who's got your uncle his Medicare and got your aunt a job, what do you think the vote would be, Shannon O'Brien?
I think it would be 70-30 in favor.
In favor. Charlie Chivio, what do you think?
Yeah, I think maybe not quite that much, but yeah, it would pass.
So assuming that's the mindset, and I agree with both of you, I think it may even be higher, frankly, but whatever it is, it's a majority. How do we get out of this mess? I don't mean this immediate mess or the debt ceiling crisis. The assumption is going to be that the polarization is not going to go away. We're going to talk in the second hour about how the media helps fuel that polarization. What causes change? Let's assume the Democrats someday take back the House, but a Republican succeeds Barack Obama. Why should we assume that anything's going to change?
See, I don't believe a Republican is going to succeed Barack Obama, and I think that's because I think that this politics is going to help the Democrats on the national level when it comes to presidential politics. But the continuing problems that the Democrats will have in terms of electing members to Congress, you know, could continue. Although there were some polls out that were showing in some sort of moderate Republican districts that Republicans could be susceptible to
that were previously thought to be safe.
Tea Party challenge.
Tea Party. No. Democratic. Oh,
I'm sorry.
I would say two things. I would say, yes, this does make it more likely that a Democrat will succeed Barack Obama. But I would also say my view of this has always been that we're talking 4 to 6 years, the Tea Party will largely be a memory flamed out of by their own incompetence.
Do you think so?
I do.
I hope so. I get worried, too, that the same group, that the Ed Meese group that was doing this strategizing to get rid of Obamacare – I mean, they're giving lots of money to different people, including these candidates, to run for re-election.
There was an article that I read in the past week, and I can't remember where it was, but it was talking about the deep-pocketed. A lot of the people sort of from the financial community who had supported Mitt Romney when he ran for president, these are not the people who are on the far right. These are the sort of business people who would like to see more pro-business policies, on the national level, and that's why they support Republicans for both Congress and for president. These are the people that ultimately, I think, put pressure. The money people, not the kind of crazy billionaires who are out there, but there are a lot of wealthy Republican businessmen and women who I think at some point in time kind of lash back and say, I'm not going to give money to my party unless they become
You'd be surprised what will happen after a couple of electoral thrashings, how quickly that money will disappear.
Well, also, some of the – I don't know if they're Republicans, but some very conservative business leaders, including the head of the United States Chamber of Commerce, who none of whom, from my understanding, were crazy about the Affordable Care Act, were at the White House with the president the other day talking about how damaging a shutdown and a default for the first time in our history would be. So I think there is that sort of notion. And by the way, it is impossible to find an economist. It's one thing. There's some people agree with Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, that a shutdown is not that big a deal. We don't have to debate that. A minority of economists. You can't find an economist who says if we default for the first time in our history on October 17th, that there's anything but bad news for the personal and American economy.
Well, it's just so depressing. I mean, I've written this before, I've said it before, but you always kind of thought until very recently that when things got desperate, that ridiculous games would go away,
and cooler heads would
prevail, and they would come in, these politicians, do the right thing for the country. Now I really get nervous that's not the case anymore.
But just last,
and this is the beginning of the end.
Just last week you saw Paul Rand speaking on an open mic with Mitch McConnell saying – they're saying
he
that
prefers
they
to be called Rand Paul, by
I'm
the way.
His friends call him Paul Rand. Excuse me, this is bizarro world, okay? Yeah. So I guess I can do that, all right? Yeah. That's a Freudian slip with a real
But
purpose.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
But anyway, Rand Paul, he was saying, I don't think they have tested the message of saying we won't negotiate. And that's the problem, is that it truly is bizarro world in that it really doesn't have to make sense. It's just, are you winning? Have you poll tested what your message is? And are you going to win the battle in the polls that day? It's crazy.
Well, see, that's why I don't quite understand the Republicans digging in even deeper. It's one thing to add Medicare cuts to the table. That may make sense strategically because that's budget related. Mm. Maybe the president will budge on that. But when you keep putting Obamacare front and center, and any, I think, an analyst, Republican and Democrat, says there is no way the president is going to move on that, how do you declare anything but defeat at the end of the process and look like you walked away with your tail between your legs? I just don't get it.
You know, we've just come through this terrible recession and the economy is still not fully recovered, obviously, and many people can relate to the idea of not paying the debts you've already incurred, not paying your Visa, not paying your MasterCard, and getting those phone calls from those people, you know, that call you 17 times a day. I mean, to think that the United States could be not literally, but figuratively in that situation. It's just upsetting as an American, I guess, to think that that could happen to us.
You know what you should do? We had Chris Matthews here on Friday because he just wrote this book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Work.
I'd
only read about 45 pages of it or 50 pages. Marjorie read the whole.
Really
I read the
good.
Rest of it this weekend. The example he cited, where literally months after not one Republican had helped Jimmy Carter, not one Republican in Congress helped Jimmy Carter deal with a debt ceiling issue.
Sign notes.
Ronald Reagan has this person call Tip O'Neill. We mentioned this on Friday and said, I need 50 votes. And O'Neill said to Reagan, you got to write a letter to my members. But he then goes and gets him 50 votes because he thought it was totally inappropriate to derail the duly elected Reagan presidency, even though he disagreed with him almost immediately after having taken. I mean, that to me is the best of American civic life.
But what else was a very strong point of that whole book how
the
Reagan courted Tip O'Neill.
Yeah.
How one of his first dinners in the White House was to invite Tip O'Neill and his wife come up to the White House, how he went to the hospital when Reagan was shot.
Oh, that story about the 23rd
Psalm.
Yes,
that was
knelt down and recited the 23rd Psalm.
Holding hands with the president.
Yeah, how they would go, I mean, how they exchange gifts, the Irish, you know, shamrock ties and stuff like that. The way Reagan charmed Tip O'Neill, and Obama is not really charming to many people.
But Obama did try to charm Boehner. I mean, and I think of the time that they went out and played golf. I mean, I do think that Obama and Boehner did try to do the Tip and Gipper kind of thing. The problem is Boehner doesn't have the luxury that when he turns around to his members and said, this is what I've negotiated, this is where we're going to go, you need to respect this guy, they're off. I mean, his majority leader, I mean, Eric Cantor, is probably sticking knives in his back as much as anybody.
Eric Cantor,
right,
the number two Republican. My favorite line from the president when he and Boehner had just begun their relationship, it was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And I'm going to paraphrase it, but Barack Obama says, I'm getting along pretty well with the speaker. He says, you know, we have a lot in common. For example, we're both people of color. And he pauses and everyone laughs. And he says, of course, his doesn't appear in nature, which I thought was a great.
How do you think John Boehner liked that?
Well, I bet you he did like it. I mean, when the president of the United States, I bet he did. In any case, we're talking to Shannon O'Brien, former Democratic state treasurer and former Democratic candidate for governor against Mitt Romney. And Charlie Chipio is the principal in Chipio. Is it Chipio Strategies? What is this thing? Chipio.
It is, indeed.
Strategies.
So I'm going to move on to the governor's
race.
Let's
go to the governor's race. Sure.
Okay. Well, you know, the fundraising is looking very good for Steve Grossman. He's doing very well, the state treasurer, fundraising-wise. But he's not doing very well in the polls. I think it was 57-10, Martha Coakley over Steve Grossman. Is this it for Steve Grossman, or can his fundraising bring him back?
And his fundraising is actually surprisingly good. I can remember, you know, back when I was running for governor in 2001, you know, trying to raise money. Back then, however, you didn't have a significant, you know, and historic mayor's race, you know, Senate races, congressional races. The fact that he's been able to raise put over $750,000 in the bank actually, I think, shows some strength for him. The other thing that people also forget, he's a very successful businessman.
Yes, he is.
When he ran for governor in 2002, he was able to write a check for $1 million. Now, he's not doing that this time. He's actually raising the money, which I think is smart for him because then he has that outlet, you know, towards the back of a potential campaign. But it's still very early in the race. You know,
do you have a candidate, by the way?
You've
not endorsed anybody yet. Okay.
No.
So, Charlie, on the Charlie Baker side of the equation, Baker put out a press release last week. I think it's Charlie's Press Shop is the place it comes from, essentially saying a pox on all their houses about this shutdown thing. I thought it was a lost opportunity. I know it's difficult to attack your own party, but if he had one great opportunity, I'm sure there'll be more, sadly, to say, listen, I'm a loyal, good Republican, but I'm not that kind of Republican. I thought it was a huge missed chance for him. What'd you think?
Yeah, you know, my initial reaction was the same to that. But I would agree with that. I also, though, have to say, from what I've seen, and I'm not, you know, I don't claim to be Charlie's closest friend or anything, but the person I'm seeing this time around is certainly much closer to the person I know rather than who he was trying to be last time. And I think that is certainly promising. But yeah, I think he did miss an opportunity there.
Yeah. I think that as the atmosphere gets more toxic down in Washington and in Massachusetts, I mean, that's one of the things that I think will hurt any Republican candidate in this state, because basically you just wrap the national party, you know, around the people here. Charlie's lucky in that even though it was close to 20 years ago, that he actually has kind of a track record affiliated with, you know, a somewhat moderate Republican administration, the Weld and Scalise administration. But his problem will also be Mitt Romney, because you can see what Mitt Romney did. He ran as a liberal Republican for governor of Massachusetts and then immediately did a 180 to pander to the Republican Party on the national level. So he has to be careful.
There's two differences there. One is that Charlie, not necessarily with the public at large, but with people involved in politics, has a much more established persona.
Yes.
And also, and I believe him when he says this, Charlie isn't looking to do anything else in national politics or anything like that. So.
Yeah. At least not until he's elected governor. He's not intending to
do. We're talking with Shannon O'Brien, the former state treasurer, and Charlie Chipio of Chipio Strategies about now we're in state politics with the gubernatorial race. What about Juliette Kayyem? She is the former Homeland Security official. She raised a considerable amount of money, $88,000 last month compared to $28,000 from Martha Coakley. What's her chances in this whole thing?
I have to tell you, I will tell you right now that she has no chance simply because of the fact that I have been very impressed by her. And anytime I'm impressed by a candidate, they're doomed.
Kiss of death.
But yeah, I think she's makes a lot of sense.
I do think one interesting thing about her candidacy is that she's coming from the Homeland Security perspective, which is not the typical female, and it'd be sexist about it, but let's face it, it's not the usual female perspective for running for office. I mean, this is her area of expertise. She was on CNN a lot about it.
Writing a Globe column, pieces about the same subject matter.
So, but the talk is that she's really going to end up running for attorney general.
Yeah, my sense is that if Martha Coakley is getting into this race, which it appears that she's going to be running for governor, I just don't think that there's room for another smart female in the race.
So?
Which is a sad commentary.
Well, if this were just one big general primary election where the voters came and they kind of looked at the candidates and they actually looked at credentials, she might have a better shot. But to win the nomination, you have to go to the convention. You have to get, X percent of the vote at the convention. Then you have to raise the money. It's just the mechanics of winning are significant. It doesn't matter how good a candidate someone might be. You have to have the mechanics there, and I just don't think she has the mechanics.
Hey, before we leave the gubernatorial topic, you're the perfect – I don't think I've ever broached this with you. I broached it with 3,000 people about your race when you ran against Romney. I think what Charlie Baker has to do – he hasn't called me for advice, so I think he's pretty safe – is the most effective thing that I think Romney used against you, which you had – there's no way to deal with. This is not a criticism of you – was the Gang of Three argument. If you love Shannon O'Brien, you're voting for her. If you love Mitt Romney, you're voting for him. But if you're in the great middle in that race – and you could go either way. And Mitt Romney says, you have a Democratic speaker. You have a Democratic Senate president. I know you're not crazy about either of them. I mean, he didn't say that, but that was the implication. Do you really want them controlling every branch of government? And I have to say, I found that to be an exquisite argument in politics. Didn't you?
Oh, absolutely. It is. I've talked about this on the show before.
I'm sorry. My apologies.
About this. Okay. Because I actually think that when it
comes
to...
Oh, you were the one. Now I remember. It's you. That's right.
No, but when you're running for... Because the House and the Senate are so overwhelmingly Democratic, the people continue to vote for Democratic state reps and state senators, but they want balance.
Exactly.
They want balance.
I agree.
And it's very difficult, I think, for a Democrat to run in that atmosphere. You have to, I think that Deval Patrick did a great job because he wasn't coming from the inside of government. He was running as an outsider.
I'm going to ask you that again when you come next time, if that's okay. I want to see if...
That's the voice of Shannon O'Brien. She was the state treasurer in Massachusetts. Charlie Chipio is with Chipio Strategy. So I think it's fair to say that Joan Vernocchi and the Globe kind of trashed Scott Brown over the weekend. Here's the lead of her column. Desperately seeking relevancy has to be the unofficial theme of Scott Brown's latest campaign. Then she lists how he was going to run for John Kerry's Senate seat, then changed his mind, then he was going to run for governor, then changed his mind, he insulted Charlie Baker, then he goes to the Iowa State Fair. Now he's talking about running in New Hampshire. So is this fair on Joan's part to say that Scott's 15 minutes is done?
First, I want to say that I was very uncomfortable with this whole topic simply because of recognizing the very special relationship Jim has with Scott.
It's true.
Yeah, everybody says this on the air. Scott Brown, it is true, is a friend of mine. I should disclose that.
I think he's more than a
friend. No, he's not more than a friend. He is a friend of mine. But let's continue.
You know, I was a big supporter, and I like Scott Brown as well, but his behavior has been bizarre, you know, and he needs to sort of, I think, either figure out what he wants to do, or until he figures out what he wants to do, sort of step back a little bit, because there is a feeling, I don't know if it's true, but there's a feeling when you watch it all that he's somebody who is just sort of scratching for the limelight. And it's,
you know, what was great about Scott Brown before he became Scott Brown was there was a large dose of humility that walked with him. And when he got elected and he started believing in that Scott Brown, that's where the problem began. And for him, and ultimately, you know, when he was running against Elizabeth Warren, he got kind of nasty. He got kind of he forgot who that Scott Brown was, that a lot of legislators who served with him or served sort of contemporaneously in government with him, as I did, that he was a pretty nice sort of regular guy. And then all of a sudden it was a very, very different kind of thing. He was a movement, and he believed he was a movement. He's got to kind of step back and become a regular guy again.
There was a great, quoting from Joan's great column too, by the way. She quote, listen to this, in a recent editorial, this is pretty funny.
The conservative, how long do you think this friendship is going to last?
The conservative union leader of Manchester,
Jim's
throwing New
him
Hampshire,
over. Throwing him over.
Sarcastically noted that Brown has done so many great Granite State events that, quote, we half expect to run into him everywhere we go. Apple picking, the Deerfield Fair, any random corn maze, which I thought was, but you know, I was about to say, having said that, but Emily Rooney and Marjorie talked about how much they hate that expression
it's okay,
on
Jim.
Friday.
It's okay.
So don't listen.
You've been traumatized.
Having said that, the guy in a recent poll in New Hampshire is within shouting distance of Gene Shaheen. He's within 4 or 5 points of an incumbent, a former governor, a current United States senator, and a very popular politician in New Hampshire. Yeah. So despite what you were all saying and agreeing with Joan, the reality is he may have a second life up there.
Well, he may, but I don't know. I mean, you know, even, you know, Bobby Kennedy moving to New York in 1964 and stuff.
Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I mean, that was a different time. I don't know how that would play out in the long run. I have my doubts.
Yeah, except New Hampshire is kind of an extension of Massachusetts, especially
that,
when it becomes the – I mean, how many people from Massachusetts have moved up there? And it really is sort of Massachusetts purple. You know what I mean? It is more Republican-leaning than this state is, but the media markets, the people, the borders are – you know what I mean? It feels like it's sort of part of Massachusetts, but not.
But you know what? I want to agree with you on the whole female dynamic here with Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown. So I remember thinking during the debates, she's slightly older than he is. She's 61 or whatever she is.
Three, I think. But whatever she is. I'm not sure.
You had this image of the varsity king kind of picking on this woman. And I think for a lot of women that are the other side of 40, and we were calling her granny in the Herald, that, you know, people, women don't like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that hurt him. The nice guy thing was
he
hurt in those debates.
He had some snide comments. And it undermined the sort of nice guy who is not partisan.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, that was the hard thing for him to overcome, is that he wasn't as nice.
And let's all, we should, in the spirit of full disclosure, say that he has told us off the air that he plans to run in the mayoral final as an independent. As well. No,
Sticker
he does
candy.
Not. Speaking of that, most people think a major issue in the mayoral race between John Connolly and Marty Walsh has arisen. Here's John Connolly, city councilor at large on Greater Boston, Emily Rooney's show, talking about the police contract situation.
I'll vote against this current police contract if it comes up for a vote. I'm hopeful that the two sides will go back in the room and get a deal done to give our police officers a raise, who've gone 5 years without a raise now, but to do it in a way that's fiscally responsible to the city.
And here is Representative Marty Walsh, the other candidate, on the very same issue.
I feel that the mayor should go back to the bargaining table with the Police Patrolman Association and renegotiate the deal. So I certainly know that if I was negotiating this contract, it would be an open, transparent process, and I'd put the finances on the table.
Okay, Charlie Chipio and Shannon O'Brien. To me, this whole contract issue has the potential to hurt Walsh, because he is associated with the unions. And the idea that he did put forward this bill in the legislature that would make arbitration final. How does he solve this problem?
I don't know. I think he relies on the fact that most voters really don't have a clue of what's going on. Because this is really bad for him. I mean, look, this is the situation here. You know, in Massachusetts, if you're a public safety union, you bargain. You don't bargain in good faith because you know that it's going to go to arbitration.
Right.
You want to have demanded as much as you possibly could, because every time this happened, the arbitrator rules somewhere halfway in between what you know, both sides. And then what that leaves you with is a situation where the only way you can get out of it is if the city council doesn't approve it. Well, in Massachusetts, 18 out of the 20 political action committees that give the most to political candidates are labor organizations, 17 unions, and the Retired Public Employees Association. So the only way that you can then get out of it is for public employees, these city council members whose careers depend on, the people that they're going to be ruling against. I mean, it's not going to happen. Their jobs are staked on these people. You know, this is my obsession. This is the whole thing of the just out of control power of public employee and private employee unions in Massachusetts politics.
You know, before we get your thoughts on this, Shannon, the Boston Herald Suffolk University poll came out this morning. Connolly leads Walsh by 7 points. Walsh, on the good side for him, has sliced the lead in half. 15-point lead Connolly held apparently last month, and they say that Walsh has some momentum. You know, so while the downside, assuming people are paying attention, I tend to agree with Charlie that it's more something that media types and those who are obsessed with public employee unions and those kind of things focus on. The flip side is I happen to believe Marty Walsh is in the final because labor turned out for him big time. So what hurts him also helps him, not to mention the fact, I think he got a huge endorsement this week. Arlene Isaacson, who is pretty much the woman who was the point person on the gay rights movement in the state, endorsed Marty Walsh, which I think puts a seal of approval among some progressives on a guy who is often seen as the less progressive guy in the race. What's your take on all that, Shannon O'Brien?
Well, first of all, just to deal with the endorsement of Arlene Isaacson, I think that plays very well, although, again, and my full disclosure, I'm actually a longtime friend of John Connolly's and supporting him in this race as well. Arlene is a dear friend of mine. She's probably one of the leading voices, for 25 years, although she would probably not want me to put that number on there. But the fact is she's one of the leading voices, and she's been there in the trenches fighting on gay civil rights, gay marriage. And so her endorsement of Marty, I think, goes a long way. That being said, you also just had John Connolly winning an endorsement of a local paper in Boston that is focused on gay issues in the city of Boston. But the labor issue, and I agree with you, I think
Did Bay Windows endorse John?
It wasn't Bay Windows. It was I don't know where Bay Windows is.
I think they're still Sue O'Connell.
Okay.
They're still undecided.
Did she walk in there after this?
What's your thought about labor's?
The labor people came out strong for Marty, and I think that spelled the difference between him coming in first or second. I think that really was very, very well organized. I actually, was working that day at the polls watching this happen, and he just had a flawless execution. I think he'll have that in the final. That being said, when people are looking at this, and when you see some of these columns that talk about what the cost of that unchallenged arbitration award could be, and people see that maybe it means some of my schools get closed down,
yep,
maybe it means less library time, maybe it means we close down a fire station, people are going to vote their pocketbooks, and I think that is not going to help Marty if they don't think that he can do this objectively.
Yeah.
And given that support, I'm not sure they think he can do
it.
Well, Charlie and I can relate to this. They're just plain old jealousy too of the people that are retiring at 50.
They changed that, Marjorie, prospectively.
Police officers are retiring quite young. And I wouldn't mind that, but they could wait till they're 65 to get their pension. I think that'd be a little bit more fair.
You know, one of the nice things, regardless of where you're on these issues, the fact that we have two smart, talented people in the final for mayor, I think, is a pretty wonderful thing.
Yeah.
One other thing, by the way, Mayor Menino, we should say, is going to be in studio with us tomorrow for a half hour. We haven't talked to him in quite a bit.
And we'll have to ask him about this because Peter Galsinis had a column in the Herald over the weekend saying that Mayor Menino's people have quietly gone with John Connolly because of some family friction involving Marty.
Is that true, Shannon O'Brien?
I can't say that for a fact, but I will tell you that I think that the people that are probably supporting John Connolly, it has more to do with this union issue and many of the developers in Boston thinking that John Connolly may be a better mayor for them to work
with.
Don't forget the moms.
That was a great article.
Well, when
moms.
You saw the polling, I mean, they very clearly, Marty is the labor guy and John Walsh is the education guy.
I do have to say, though, speaking of what you said about the two bright people in this campaign, I mean, I too would like to see Connolly elected. But, Marty Walsh really, he kind of breaks the mold.
Yeah,
he's not a typical, he's got this history, cancer survivor. you know, he's substance abuse, and he's really stuck with that. And
tough
he's really,
vote in his district on gay rights issues, by the way.
No, he's
they're both great.
They're good.
I worked with him, too, when I was in government. He's a good guy.
Yeah, we'll
good
see
guy.
What the
okay,
mayor thinks of the two candidates tomorrow.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks,
we're speaking
you
with former state treasurer Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Chipio, principal at Chipio Strategies. Okay, when we come back, we're going to ask you about women's colleges, because both Pine Manor and Mount Holyoke are now going co-ed. Does the all-female school show women they can be leaders, or do they fail to prepare young women for the real world? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH.
In an increasingly competitive academic landscape, some women's colleges continue to thrive, while others are struggling to fill their seats.
97% of the young women do not want a single-sex institution.
I think there's a lot to be lost because you lose that sense of empowerment.
I'm on-campus reporter Kirk Carapezzo with that story this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Bentley University, the unique blend of business and the arts and sciences, is just one hallmark of an education that puts a whole world of opportunity at your fingertips. Bentley, the business university. And Orchard Cove, welcoming, lively. These are some of the words residents use to describe this independent senior community in Canton. You can learn more and arrange a tour at orchardcovelive.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan. This morning, our higher education reporter and colleague, Kirk Carapezza, reported on how women's colleges are struggling to survive. Locally, Mount Holyoke, Pine Manor, opening their classrooms to men. 50 all-women colleges continue to exist. That's down from 250 in the 1950s. By the way, 8 of them are still in New England. Discussion is made more interesting by the following disclosures, which we feel we have to make. I am not a fan of all women's colleges, but my older daughter attends one, Smith. She loves it, as do I. I can't explain it. I'm just reporting it. Marjorie is a fan of all women's colleges, though she left one, Smith, and transferred to Stanford. So now that you're scratching your heads, does this trend trouble you? Are women's colleges what some young women need to make it in today's world, or do they create an artificial divide? Joining us to kick off this conversation, we'll get to your calls in a couple of minutes, is Roz Burnett. Roz is a senior scientist at the Women's Studies Research Center and executive director of its Community, Families, and Work program at Brandeis. She's also co-author of a new book with the great Carol Rivers. It's called The New Soft War on Women. Roz, it's great to talk to you.
Nice talking to you.
Hi, Roz.
Hi.
So what do you think about women's colleges, Roz? What's your take, having done so many years of research on these types of subjects?
Well, I think the original rationale for women's colleges was to give women an opportunity to get an elite education, because they were locked out of the all-elite male colleges, obviously. And so that was the original rationale. And that now, of course, is not so much a rationale anymore. Women are, even in the women's colleges, Wellesley, for example, has cross-registration with MIT. Bryn Mawr has cross-registration with Haverford and Swarthmore, and so forth. And so, in fact, you don't have women being locked out of men's schools anymore, but you have some women's schools that are single-sex. And so I think that the original rationale is no longer, as I said before, in place. There may be some arguments still for having an all-female environment, but I think that argument is, on a scientific ground, is diminished. So there's still people who prefer a single-sex education for whatever reason, but I don't think you can argue that if a more rigorous or less competitive or whatever environment with an all-female student body. I think that you have students who qualify for any of these schools are super-duper students, and they're going to get a super education wherever they go. And some women seem to want to be in a co-ed environment, and some don't, but the realization that women and men really want more or less the same kind of things out of life and have similar abilities undercuts some of the rationale, and I think it explains some of the movement away from single-sex schools, not only here, but in Europe, for example, certainly in England, there's been a rapid decline in single-sex schools, more towards the co-ed. So I think that's the handwriting on the wall.
Well, you know, this is anecdotal because it's only me, but I do remember feeling in the time I was at Smith, and I did leave, as Jim said, it was hard to get a date. That was one of the problems. But besides that, there was this little oasis in my life where this whole institution was run by women. It was for women. It was all about women. And you didn't go to a co-ed school where the girls' gym was little and the boys' gym was enormous. And the girls had the second class, even though we have Title IX and all that, it was still second-class sports program. The boys had all the big-deal sports programs. I mean, you did notice, and I did notice, going from Smith, which was totally about women succeeding, mm-hmm. to a co-ed school, you did lose that. And I think when you're 17, even in 2013 or 18, a young woman, the confidence factor, I don't think – I really credit Smith with giving me that kind of you-can-do-whatever-you-want kind of confidence.
I think that's probably true. I think it was maybe – more important at a time when there wasn't an environment that encourages women earlier on. Now, obviously, women don't get the same encouragement as men all the way through elementary and middle schools and so forth, but it is changing, and there are many more women role models around. So I think women have a different view of things, and don't think the women's schools play that kind of a unique role that they did back when we were in college.
But Roz Burnett, and by the way, you and Carol Rivers wrote another book a couple of years ago that obviously has great relevance. It was called The Truth About Girls and Boys, Challenging right. Toxic Stereotypes About Our Children.
Right.
Marjorie just cited an anecdotal experience. Let me be non-anecdotal.
Right.
There's a piece in USA Today about a week ago in which the Office of Institutional Research, Planning, and Assessment of Boston College did two surveys of women at their school. The first was when they were incoming freshmen. The second was when they were exiting seniors. And in this poll, female seniors, according to the USA Today, left the university with lower self-confidence when they entered as freshmen. At least the intimation is that that is in part because they don't get the same level of attention and focus because men, young men, I guess, in this case, 70 to 21-year-olds, are dominating the discussion. And how do you respond to that?
Well, I'd like to know more about it. For example, did they also survey the men that came in? And what happened to the men's self-esteem or whatever between the first and fourth year? And is it a function of age, moving out into the senior year and looking forward to a work environment? Or is it really a gender thing? I mean, do they look at...
I don't know the answer.
Well, I mean, then I don't think you can really speculate about whether it's a gender thing or not. I mean, that's one of the issues with doing research where you only look at one gender. So it's easy then to conclude, oh, this is about women or it's about men if it's all about a male sample. Unless you have a comparable study with the other gender, you really can't conclude anything about gender differences.
But, you know, I haven't done the research that you and Carol Rivers did, needless to say, and you wrote this book, much of which I read at the time. Mm-hmm. And now let me get anecdotal like Marjorie. I've been in high school classrooms. I've been in college classrooms where the boys never shut up, even if they have no idea what they're talking about. And the women almost never have an opportunity, young women have an opportunity to be heard. Is that just anecdotal, or is that not much more common than I thought?
It might be, but that seems to me that's a function of the teacher, not the student.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, who knows? I mean, hopefully, teachers are becoming more trained and attentive to all this. If they just call on the boys or let the boys take over, then that's really the teacher's problem. So I think, I know Carol's observation, again, anecdotal, in her classes at BU is the girls are much more forthcoming and assertive than they were in her memory. And very much more as assertive as the boys, so it's hard to generalize, but I do think that gender awareness and these issues of diversity and are becoming something that's talked about much more frequently, and that may help teachers become sensitized to what they're doing, not overtly. I mean, I think this our culture we have a very sex stereotype culture, so some of these beliefs are ingrained and we have them from very very early years. And they get played out. But I think there is some new movement. I definitely do think there's more movement.
Well, Roz Barnett, thank you so much for taking the time
Roz.
To be with us. We much appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Say hi to Carol for us, please.
Roz is a senior scientist at the Women's Studies Research Center and executive director of its Community, Families, and Work program at Brandeis N., co-author of the new book with Carol Rivers, The New Soft War on Women. So, Jim, you have a kid that's a Smith right now.
Yeah, she is.
Does she ever talk about that whole thing? It's all run by women, about women,
yes.
For women kind of stuff?
Even though, as I said candidly,
and this is 2013.
You and I have discussed this many times on the radio and off the radio.
Yeah.
I believe it creates an artificial environment, and even if it strengthens,
yeah, it does.
Even if it strengthens a young woman there, I worry that when they return to a non-artificial environment, namely one in which there are men and women, that they're going to be ill-prepared for that. Having said that, she loves it, and I have to say I love it. So for once, I'm going to try to crack my mind open enough, even though if I were the deciding vote, I don't like them. I don't like them because, again, it's an artificial environment for young women. I think they have to be prepared to deal with a world in which men are, frankly, and there isn't a teacher in front of the room, men are not very kind when it comes to sharing the stage.
Well, you know something else? Really?
877, I knew, I was waiting. It's 877-301.
I almost missed my opportunity.
8970 is our number. What's your sense? We'd love to hear from people who went to women's colleges,
yeah,
who decided not to go to one, or if you have a kid there. But also, just what's your perspective on the fact we still have 50, as I said. Kirk, our colleague, reported that there are only 50 left, 8 of which are in New England. And the notion is they're about to become a vanishing breed, that essentially, for financial reasons, more and more, like the Pine Manors, and what was the other one that I mentioned? Mount Holyoke. They are all, or most at least, going to be in a position where they have to open their classroom to young men.
You know what else? And this sounds silly, and it shouldn't be a factor, but it is. I mean, I hear it from young people that are, you know, that I've got 2 kids in college. I hear it all the time. A girl in business school. That there's a lot of women who don't like to be overly assertive in class. You know why? Because they want to get asked out. It's ridiculous.
Is that really true?
Absolutely. That you know
what?
The smartest
and the notion
girl,
is, young man doesn't want an assertive, strong woman.
A lot of men don't, Jim. Even in 2013.
Well, they don't want to be dating those guys, I guess, is what my response.
Yeah, I
would
guess
be.
That's true. But I think that there's a lot. I mean, you hear this in high school, you hear this in college, you hear this in business school. We saw that massive long piece in the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago about Harvard Business School. Some of the smartest women in the country at Harvard Business School, and they're worried about their dateability if they're 5 times smarter than the guy next to them. It's just incredible. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. I mean, you know, I couldn't get either of my daughters to even look at Smith for 2 seconds. But I think it's a fantastic school, and I think there's nothing wrong at all for being in that little cocoon for 4 years. Yes, the whole world is going to be different, but it gives you, especially if you're not someone with a lot of confidence intellectually, it gives you
that.
Was
it that important to you, as you said to Roz a minute ago? It really was just
huge.
2 years there?
Now,
was
I'm a
that
lot
important?
Older than your daughter, obviously, but
yeah.
It changed my life.
Really?
Yes, because I came of age in the 70s, and, you know, I heard Gloria Steinem speak, and I came from a place that wasn't very, you know, from Fall River, which is, you know, a tough old mill town. So going to Smith College absolutely changed my life.
And that's
absolutely
why she left. 877-301-8989. We're a bundle of inconsistencies, but we are what we are. What's
in
that?
Retrospect, where was the better education? Smith.
Better than Stanford, huh?
Absolutely.
Well, Danielle, you're in a car, and you are first on at least this topic here on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for the call. Hi, Danielle.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you both?
We're great. Thank you.
I have you folks on speed dial, which is kind of creepy, if you ask me.
Boy, that is really creepy, but we love it, Danielle. Go ahead.
I am a Smith College alum, and I absolutely was changed forever by my experience at Smith.
In a good way. In a good way.
Women, my former husband said before I went to Smith, I was a very self-confident woman when I was impossible.
there you go.
And that's a good thing. But the whole idea that women in women's colleges are in an artificial environment, I believe that's true for everyone who goes to college. College is an artificial
environment.
That's a very
good point,
that
actually.
Is a great point, Danielle.
And I'm an Ada Comstock Scholar, which is a program for older women returning to college.
I know exactly what it is.
You would, of course, with a daughter at Smith. I think that's what's allowing Smith to stay a woman's school, because they have so many older students on campus.
Danielle, if only everybody had us on speed dial like you, we'd be a happier world. Danielle, thank you so much for a great call. Let's go to Fall River, where Mike is on the phone. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Oh, hi, guys.
Hey.
So,
thanks.
So, actually, I went to a private Catholic all-girls school my freshman year at college. It was his first year co-ed.
Oh.
Okay.
What was that like?
Interesting.
Which school, Mike?
Immaculata University.
Oh, yes.
Oh, sure.
Yep. And let me tell you, like, all-girls school, nothing against them, but when they go co-ed, they don't make it easy on the guys. I'll tell you that one.
What percentage of that first co-ed class was men? What, 10% or something?
There was 90 guys in the entire school.
Out of how many? 1,000? How many people went to?
I think there's 3,500 total.
Wow, okay.
Wow.
So it's like 3%. Okay.
Yeah, very, very low. And it was a bit rough for the guys coming to the school. I don't think the faculty and the staff of the school were prepared to have men on campus or deal with how men act in college. Let's put it that way.
And did you last for 4 years?
Oh, no. I actually transferred back to Framingham State for my sophomore year.
Because of that, Mike?
Yeah, it was just a little too rough. The nuns didn't really appreciate guys being on campus too much.
Mike, that is a fine call. Thank you.
I forgot about the nuns. The nuns didn't know quite what to do with all those 20-year-old young men. Let's go to Kim in Southborough. What do you think about women's colleges, Kim?
Hi, Kim.
Oops, did I go to the wrong place?
That's okay. Hi, Kim.
I'm sorry. Kim from Southborough. I goofed that up. Hi, Kim.
Yes. Hi, how are you guys?
Great. Thank you for the call.
Thank you for taking the call. I am actually a product of a women's college here in New England, and I do agree with Jim in that it is an artificial environment. I think it was a very positive experience, and I have wonderful friends from it, but it's definitely not the real world.
Yeah, it's not. But didn't it give you that little, I can compete in the real world sort of grounding? That's how I felt about it.
A little bit, yes. Definitely established a confidence that you can do it very early in life and, you know, in the formative years. You know, I was 17, 18 when I first started there. But it's not the business world, real life. You know, there are two sexes out there that you do have to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very thankful for my education there. It was very positive. But I wish that I had the co-ed experience.
Where'd you go? Where was it, Kim?
Regis College in Weston.
Oh, yeah, we know Regis College.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Kim, thanks.
Which has since gone, it has gone co-ed for financial reasons, as you guys were discussing earlier.
Well, again, most of them are. They talk about in Kirk's, actually, piece and elsewhere, is that the audience that you have is so limited. It's not only do you exclude all young men, but you exclude a huge percentage of young women who obviously don't want to go to a single-sex school. So the audience is... It's slim pickings, and I guess they're on the way to disappearance with some notable exceptions. Kim, thanks for the call. Why are you smiling like that?
Well, I think when I brought my oldest daughter up to look at Smith College, we get out of the car and we see two young women with these triangles on their jackets that say, "Down with the patriarchy."
Is that what it's, there's a lot of that. There is a lot of it.
And she thought, I don't know, this is a place where I want to go. So there is a little bit of that. Valerie from Clinton, what do you think about a single-sex women's schools, Valerie?
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Actually went to 6 years of high school and middle school at an all-female Catholic school in Rhode Island, and it was really the best educational experience of my life. I was challenged and also really forced to pay attention to my education and how to get my voice heard, and because of that, I considered all-female colleges, but I actually went to Wheaton College in Norton, Mass., which is a formerly all-female college.
Yes. Valerie, which Catholic girls' school in Rhode Island? I'm just curious.
I went to St. Mary's Academy Bayview,
which was a
fantastic experience. I loved it. And I'm not Catholic, but it also really, like, pruned me to be the person that I am today. And I feel like my identity and my educational attainment, I have a double master's degree now, really came because of that 6 years at Bayview. And in college in Wheaton, you know, there were 60% female, 40% male, and they went co-ed because of money as well back in the 80s. And I was able to raise my hand, and I was able to challenge, you know, the sports-driven culture that was starting to develop at the college. And I became really, really involved in these conversations and have thus continued that conversation into my real world. And I understand that it is a semi-artificial environment, but I do feel that all women's colleges and all women's educational opportunities allow for girls and young women to develop their confidence, develop their voice, and really articulate where they want to go, and thus give them the confidence to challenge the status quo later on in the business world.
Valerie, that was a great call. Thank you very much. You said it perfectly. Thank you, Valerie.
We have a woman emailing Elizabeth who went back to Wellesley in her 50s to get a post-baccalaureate degree. She said it changed her life. And then we have Stephen, who said his experience in co-ed schools revealed that most of the women there were expert at acting as though the young men in class did not exist. So I guess Stephen didn't have a great experience with the women in his classes.
Let's squeeze one more in if we can. Heather, you're in Worcester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling in. Hi, Heather.
Hi. I'm a graduate of Simmons many, many years ago. My daughter landed up there not at all because she was choosing a woman's college, but just of the 10 colleges she interviewed at, she went there and chose it because she liked it in her, the interview process. I mean, it wasn't interviewed. She was just taken around the school. And she also went to a Catholic school for 1 year in high school because she was having trouble with a boy stalking her, and she just needed to get away. A kind of stalking. I mean, it was just too much pressure in a way. And that experience for that 1 year, she ended up going back to the high school her senior year. So, and she has, I just think it is a good experience for many young women, especially women who haven't been very empowered in their personal.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, Heather. And thank you for the call. I hope they don't go. It would kill me if Smith or Wellesley went co-ed.
Well, that's the moral of the story, and I think these discussions. For certain women,
yes,
it is the right
place. It's a big, big deal.
Even if Roz Burnett and Carol Rovers are right and that our theories about the differences between how young boys and girls learn is wrong, if this is what a young woman needs that suits her thing at that particular time, then it's great they're there. It's pretty obvious from these calls. Why
so,
are you looking
so,
like that?
So you changed your mind on women's college. Is this correct?
I've changed my mind for my daughter. Yes, I have.
Okay.
And I'm thinking about changing my mind on the larger thing, but I have yet. I'll let you be the first to know. As soon
okay,
as I do,
Jim.
I'll call you.
Thank you very much. Okay, when we come back, it's time for Open Mic with the Reverend Gene Rivers III. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Government shutdowns can be kind of abstract, but also very, very real.
Now, with the shutdown, orders can't come in. There's no one to fill out the paperwork. There's no one to place the orders. So it's taking a slow system and slowing it down even more.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Government Interruptus goes on. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Old Sturbridge Village, where you can see brilliant fall foliage and enjoy old-fashioned harvest events, meet the farm animals, ride the stagecoach, see hearth cooking, and the blacksmith at work. Details at osv.org. And the Hanover Theater, in partnership with Music Worcester, presenting the Michael Feinstein Trio at the Hanover Theater in Worcester, October 12th at 8 p.m. You can visit thehanovertheater.org for more information.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3 for Open Mic, as he does on Mondays, is the Reverend Eugene Rivers III. Reverend Rivers made news with a front page story in the Herald just after the preliminary election in Boston, excoriating communities of color for their lackluster turnout. He made headlines again a couple of days later when the Globe's Adrian Walker wrote that the Reverend was part of the reason for that lackluster turnout, having failed to vote for his candidate, Charlotte Gola-Ritchie, or for that matter, any of his candidates for quite a long time. Here to discuss that and related things is the Reverend Eugene Rivers. Hello, Reverend Rivers.
Hello, good people. How y'all doing?
Hi, excellent. Gene. Thanks for being here.
So you wrote a piece after this saying that you hadn't voted for 30 years.
Yes.
So why not?
There are two answers. Number one, publicly, it was indefensible.
publicly, it's indefensible, right? If you're a public figure like I reluctantly recognize that I am, there was no excuse. And I wrote in the second piece, I apologize. I confess my guilt. I was publicly and gushingly contrite in confessing my sins. Oh, so absolutely. Right now, there is a private philosophic kind of discussion about my conception and theory of what electoral politics is that I did not get into. But I was wrong. I was absolutely wrong.
But I guess what I don't understand is you were talking about the lackluster vote and the black.
No, community. No, that's not. No, wrong. I want to correct that.
Okay.
I want to correct that.
Well,
that's
you,
no.
It was in the
in
piece.
Fact, no, this is the thing. One-fifth of the piece is that. The bulk of the argument, which we're going to come back to because that's being avoided.
Okay.
All right?
But,
so, no. But I want to go there. I got to push you back.
But, Gene, one-fifth, one-sixth, one-tenth.
No, but that's not the bulk of the argument. I got to press you on this. Now, I want to come to the fact that I was wrong. I want to come back to that, right? No, I want to say again, publicly. Then this is like the 10th time.
Right.
And I'll probably do it 50 more times, right? That was wrong. That was my voting record was wrong. And I stated that.
Yep.
And in fact, since we're on this and you want to push this point, when I spoke to Adrian Walker after he tweeted last week, and he says, Rivers, I understand that you haven't voted since 1997. I said, you need a fact checker, Adrian Walker. It's actually worse than that. I haven't voted since 1983.
Yeah, but Gene Rivers,
but
the one thing you haven't answered is Margaret's...
Hold on, though. I just want to get back to this, though.
Okay, sure.
You have talked about lackluster voting in the black community. It had to occur...
In this article, yeah.
It had to occur to you, Gene Rivers, that this was the pot calling the kettle black or whatever it is.
So
this
to speak.
No, absolutely. In fact...
Hypocritical.
Yeah, no, not hypocritical. Inconsistent, but not hypocritical. And I want to press on that because this is the issue. This is actually interesting. I had actually gone out and registered to vote. The first time I had actually gone out 3 weeks ago, it's all part of the public record, to register to vote and ran around doing stuff, getting other people out to vote and didn't get to vote. I had actually planned on this occasion, on this rare occasion.
To break the streak.
Absolutely. No, I had actually planned to go vote. Now, I didn't get into that discussion because it sounded, I didn't want to make excuses. But I actually registered to vote this time to vote. And did not get to the polls.
Okay, but Gene Rivers, back to Marjorie's original question, which is the one that I haven't heard you answer 10 times. Why? I mean, you offered that, as you just said, that not only have I not voted since the mid-90s, as Adrian Walker wrote, but you hadn't voted from Mel King 30 years ago till now. Why did you choose not to vote in all those elections where you, in many of them, I assume, cared deeply about the outcome?
Well, two things. There is a larger view I have of the electoral process and what it actually produces. Even when black people turn out 100%.
What's the larger view?
The larger view is that in certain cases, not all, right, the electoral process does not, for the very poor, produce measurable outcomes.
So why do you urge other people to vote if you think that that's
voting? That's a rationale. You asked me my view.
Yeah.
I have a personal view.
No, I asked you why.
Yeah, okay, no.
Okay.
I have a personal view, which is irrelevant, frankly, right? My philosophic view, my theory of the function of electoral politics for poor people, that's one view. And then there's a public view, and on that issue, I was wrong. And I said, yeah, I should have voted. And let me say this. I should have. I'll go further. I should have. And there's no rationalization for it. It was a thing. It was a transgression, which is wrong. And I have been transparent and public and
once
deny
it. Once you were caught, you were transparent.
Well, no, it's not even caught because I never tried to hide it. No. Au contraire. There was no attempt because had I tried to hide it, in fact, when he said 97, I said wrong. 1983. And in fact...
Gene, if I had said to you, we actually listened to this a couple of days ago. If I had said to you, the day I was off, I think Peter and Marjorie said, did you vote for Charlotte Gullah Ritchie? And you said something like, I support Charlotte Gullah Ritchie, which obviously is carefully chosen. If I had said to you the day after the election, did you vote for Charlotte? Yes, sir. What would you have said? Forget Adrian Walker. If I just said, no. had you would have said what?
I would have said, no, I didn't vote. I would have said that.
And so
I would have said that.
Here's the thing, though, I don't get. Because, you know, there's a lot of people who think you're a grandstander and think you're not doing everything you say you do. You have a lot of people that don't like
you. I have critics. Rivers.
You have a lot of critics.
Yeah, okay. So I don't know how many I got. This is Boston. But
we're counting them, actually. Boston. We'll get back to you on that.
But it's almost to me, it's kind of like, you know, a death wish in a way.
Not at all. No, that's completely off. No,
you
no.
mean to write the piece at the same time
no,
that you're
no,
not?
No, I mean,
no, there's
to,
no death wish. Listen, we're talking about, we're talking about a very small Black community in a relatively small town. So, and that's number one. Number two, there's no death wish. It's not that big. No, it really isn't. We're talking about a little teeny town.
Yeah,
Marjorie, come on.
But Blacks have fought. Let's go there. For voting rights
Let's go there. Look, Black people fought. It's not that deep, right? It's like saying that John Kennedy is not an honorable man and a great president because he had some other problems. No death wish there, right? Do you deny that John Kennedy was a great president?
Well, I don't know if he's a great president. He was
pretty good. President?
He was
pretty good.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Despite all his flaws, he's still a pretty good president, right?
Yeah, I think he would have been better off if he hadn't done all what
flaws,
he did with the women.
His imperfections don't mean he's not a pretty good president, right? So my point is that there's no death wish. It's not that important. We're talking about a small town and an off-year election. So let's not exaggerate the significance of it.
But they haven't all been off. But they haven't all been off year elections.
No, no, I agree.
Gene, in your defense, and I want to give you a little bit of defense. So that you don't have to say positive things about yourself. Adrian Walker, who did out you, I should say, said in the same column.
God bless him.
Now, Rivers' failure at citizenship should be kept in perspective. The good he has done for young people in the city is beyond measure. He's been a consistent and effective prod to people in power. Even when he's wrong, he's usually stimulating. But at the other end of the spectrum, there's Bill Forey, who discloses in a piece he wrote, he's the editor of Dorchester Reporter, that he's the husband of Linda Dorsina Forey, who you did not support. In fact, you supported Nick Collins and didn't vote for him in the state Senate thing. Mm-hmm. He says, and here's a quote, "It is now well established and beyond dispute that that Rivers is a fraud and a hypocrite, period." What do you think when you read that?
I didn't read it.
Well, now that you've heard it, what do you think of what
Forey said? The same thing I thought before I heard it.
Which is what?
Nothing.
Okay.
Let me answer your question. You see, look, when people take shots like that, ad hominem shots, because there's actually a term for those kinds of arguments, argumentum ad hominem.
Yes.
When folk take ad hominem shots, if you're an adult person, you don't take that seriously because it's really not worth discussing.
Gene Rivers, a couple of years ago, you invited me out to coffee.
Yes.
We meet at the L.J. Baker house. We're walking down the street. I told Marjorie this story to a Dunkin' Donuts, where I had to pay, by the way.
Yeah.
You know what? I know
it was tight for you.
No,
right.
I'm serious. As we're walking down the street, I remember a kid walks up to you and says, "Reverend Rivers, thanks for getting me into so-and-so."
Right.
Next block, a mother says, "Reverend Rivers, thanks for getting my kid into the boxing club," whatever.
Yeah.
So that young kid who stopped you first stops you tomorrow outside your house and said, "Reverend Rivers, I'm a huge believer in democracy," or whatever. Then I read you didn't vote in the election a week ago Tuesday in my hometown, where I'm really concerned about crime and distribution of services equitably. What do you say to that kid who sees you as a role model?
Let me tell you what actually happened in the Black community, to go to the death wish business. In the Black community, when the first thing dropped and bootleg 106.1 radio station in Grove Hall were on me for 6 hours.
This is Charles Clemens.
Clemens was on me for 6 hours. So I'm walking around, you know, recently, the young Black people come up to me, real young Black people that I've helped in Dorchester. They said, "Look, Reverend Rivers, you know what? You know what this is all about? You were absolutely right. Now, you got to vote, Reverend Rivers." Now, I'll give you the quote. "You got to vote. Because you know they're going to be on you, and they'll jump on you." This is what the young kids.
But you don't
says.
Believe that every young Black kid believes what those kids said. I'm sure some are disappointed in
you. No. You know what? I'll tell you what. After church yesterday, right, I said, "Listen, y'all, I was wrong. I should have voted. Mea culpa, mea culpa." So I said, "Listen, y'all got no skin in the game. I want to have you communicate with me your feelings about the whole thing, right? Give me your feedback, criticism, and these are not slavish. It's not a cult, right? So no weirdness, right?" So the response I got, and this is across the board, the response I got, and I'll tell you where I did. I got my first piece of hate mail. I was going to actually bring it in for you folks, right? Talk about death wish, right? My first piece of formal hate mail. It was a greeting card that had the word, half the word is whole.
Okay.
Got it? Right? Then it opened up and said, "That's all." Then it was signed, Jesse Jackson. They signed that. It was obviously not Jesse Jackson, right? But that was, you know, my issue. So the response I've gotten as I talk to young black people that know me in the neighborhood, has been the response. I go in a barbershop, black barbershop, right? Dominican black barbershop. Guy grabs me, says, Reverend Rivers, let me tell you something. We all know that we messed up and the people are attacking. And here, I don't solicit this. So I'm just communicating to you that at the rank and file street level, if you were to, without me, go to Fields Corner, Four Corners, or any black part of Dorchester and say, what y'all think about this, right? It's not what the Reverend Rivers, you got to vote. I'm telling you, right?
Is it your church or a different church?
No, it's my church.
So yeah. What happened? Let's assume you encounter, and I would hazard to say they do exist, Gene Rivers.
Sure.
Let's assume a kid came up to you and said, I'm really disappointed.
Right.
But frankly, I heard your argument on Boston Public Radio about, you know, public versus private citizen.
Yeah.
I, John, am a private citizen. I'm not going to vote either in the final election. I just registered. I was going to vote for Connelly or Walsh. I'm not going to vote. You agree with me, right, Reverend?
Right. I would say, listen, don't follow my bad example. That would be hypocrisy. Don't follow my bad example. You need to go out and vote. And I'm going to tell you why. And I'm not going to go into that conversation on this radio station about that. You need to go vote. I don't want you to follow my example. In fact, I'll tell you what we'll do. On November 4th, we're going to hook up. And then you and I on November 5th, when half the media in the planet Earth follows me or is outside my house finding out whether or not Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III votes, which is what I'm going to do.
Well, I'm not trying to get in the psychologist's couch here, but I suppose
well,
I'm
going to do it anyway.
And I'm not comparing you to Newt Gingrich on his third wife, but I remember during the whole Monica Lewinsky thing.
That's a bit deep.
I'm going there only making the analogy. You know, he was criticizing Lewinsky? Bill Clinton all the time, and there he was carrying on with the second wife. So I'm thinking to myself, here you are, you're supporting, you know, Nick Collins when he ran against Linda Dorsey-DeFore, when you're supporting Charlotte Gola Ritchie.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe this is just me, but I've been thinking to myself, God, if people find out that I haven't voted, this is going to be devastating to me as a voice from my community.
No, I'm not even on the voice from my community. I want to go to that voice for my community language, right? Look, see, I was not trying to hide anything. You got to get this now, right? That this was not a conspiracy. No one's trying to be slick.
So you weren't worried about getting out?
No, I wasn't. No. In fact, you know what? Quiet as it's kept. You know, I really don't think about myself like that. I don't, right? In other words, I don't sit up and say, should I take X position or that position and how's it going to look? I do what I think is right. And when I'm wrong, I publicly acknowledge it. I did not have sex with that woman since you insist on the Clinton analogy, right? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't do that. I was wrong. This was very clear. When confronted with it, I owned it. All right, now.
It's so easy to go vote.
Let me tell you. You're right. So on those occasions, I'm lazy. I buy that. But you know what? I want to push back on you, Marjorie.
Okay.
Because the real issue here is about ideas, argument, and debate. And before I go into that, because that's the real issue here, I never have purported anywhere to speak for black people. It is a lie for anyone to suggest at any time, right? In this little teeny town that I have attempted or purported to speak for black people. Now, what I do is speak to issues that I care about. That's it. I have never. It's a lie. It's a, you know, what was it? A perfidious lie, being redundant, right?
Don't look at me.
Right? No, it is false. Now, there is a bigger issue. And I'm going to come back to 3/4 of the article, Marjorie, that we didn't talk about.
Before you do, and I do want you to do that, the last question I have on the voting thing is,
yes.
I know I saw Maria Stefanos on Fox did a fine interview with you
great.
Shortly thereafter. She did a great job.
That's very good.
And
news
you
about
said, and you invited her afterwards, come follow me on the fish. She
Absolutely.
Said, yes, we'll do.
If be like this a Pied Piper on
if this hadn't
5th.
Happened,
oh, yeah, yeah. I'm with you there, Marjorie.
If this hadn't happened, Reverend Rivers, if this hadn't happened, this whole issue post your column in the Boston Herald,
the
reality is, you wouldn't have voted on November 5th either. The only reason you're voting on November 5th is because you were out.
No. Wrong.
After 30 years, this is the election you're going to vote in?
No. I'm going to repeat what I said because you missed it. You weren't listening carefully. I said I registered. I actually went out, registered to vote because I had planned to vote. No.
But you didn't.
No, I didn't. No, I told you why I didn't. I had planned to vote. I am going to vote. Now, was this an incentive to ensure that Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III votes? Absolutely. That's not physics. So I own that. I accept it. But I want to come back to three-fourths of the
you
article.
You can do that now. Let's
right.
do
okay,
it.
So
yeah,
let's
but,
get
well,
which is one last thing. Then we'll come back to
we're going to talk Clinton.
When
no, we're not going to talk about a dress.
I want to know.
Not a dress with some bad liquid on it. Okay,
I
all right.
I want to know about who was the last person you voted for.
I don't even remember. Do you remember
who
voted for
30
years?
Do you remember the last time you voted?
I
don't know. I might remember presidents.
I don't know. It's not important.
I remember Reagan versus...
No. You know, your mind is sharper than mine.
Well,
don't remember.
I wouldn't.
In any case,
no,
okay, three quarters.
Okay, so we got that. Well, so we okay with that?
You don't remember the last time.
I'm telling
but did you,
what's
have that? You. Have you voted since you've been 21?
I don't remember.
You don't remember?
No,
you don't remember ever going to the polls?
No.
Wait, you may never have voted?
No, I'm not even sure. I'm telling the truth.
So you may never have voted in an election?
That might be true.
That might be true. Okay.
Yeah. But here again, no cover up. I want to go back to this, right?
Yeah.
So that there's no story. You know, you got guys calling me frauds. And what else did my friend say?
He called you. He said that it is beyond dispute that Rivers is a fraud and a hypocrite, period, is what he wrote.
That's why I love it. What paper does he write for?
You know where he writes.
No, I don't.
Yes,
literally.
You do. Okay. Dorchester Reporter before he's the editor there. Gene, you've asked a few times, so we do want to give you the time. You said three questions. And it is true, by the way, when you read his initial piece, a small part of it is about the lackluster turnout. I think an important part.
Yes, it is.
Three
Don't
quarters
it.
Of it is about other issues. Go ahead.
All right. So I want to come back to the bulk of the majority of the article, and raise the issue. And because on this, I'm going to be, listen, Marjorie, I'll be voting after I'm dead. I take the point. All right. When I'm dead, I'm going to vote. I'm going to make sure that a ballot is cast for me with my daughter and my son. So we got that.
Okay.
Right. So we got that. We got.
Wouldn't
I
it be incredible if the first time you ever voted was when you were dead? Wouldn't that be amazing?
That'd be fascinating, right?
It'd be unbelievable.
Absolutely. All right, so good. So now, the issue that is not going to go away, regardless of the voting record of a relatively insignificant clergyman in the hood, is that there are ideas and there was an argument. And there needs to be a debate, a rational debate about what's going on in the black community. And it doesn't have to be. I don't have to participate in it, right? I'm not the one that needs to lead it. But it has to happen. The objective of the article was to say, what is going on in 30 years? Black people are not in a significantly better place given the extraordinary development in the city. Now, that's a
30 years, meaning since Mel King was in the
Mel
final
King
with
and,
Ray
and then
Flynn.
Just around economic development in the city. This is an extraordinary town. I love this town, right? And I take my licks like a man when I get called on my stuff. Accept it, own it. Now, I am concerned that there is an attempt to suppress debate and discussion.
About what?
About the issue of black leadership. There is an attempt to suppress it. So we'll do the ad hominem thing on Rivers. And I accept that. But then someone, William Jewis Wilson, read the most famous sociologist alive in the world, said, listen, this is an enormously important subject. You've done an excellent job. This is what needs to be discussed. That's William Jewis Wilson, Harvard University, the most famous sociologist alive.
Who is trying? What's an example, Gene? I'm not quarreling with you. I just don't know. What's an example of an organized attempt to suppress, use your words, to suppress black leadership or discussion?
No.
A discussion of black leadership.
Okay. There have been a number of individuals who said, we've got to critically evaluate how the black community is performing. See, and another part of the crime, another part of my crime, in addition to the inconsistency, is that I introduced my ideas in the wrong platform. Part of my political crime here was that this was published in the Herald.
Why?
Right, that's a political crime. You don't know that?
No, I didn't know that. Why would it be?
Oh, you didn't know that?
No.
Okay. I don't believe you don't know
that. Because Adrian Walker from The Globe?
No. I'm saying that it...
Because
it's politically...
Because the Herald's a politically incorrect newspaper, is that it?
Thank you.
Oh, but okay.
The Herald's a politically incorrect paper. And Rivers, why would you have your big head, you know, plugged on the cover of this paper in an essay which is about an idea and an argument? There's an idea and an argument. And my point is that the objective was to promote some rational discourse. It could be other actors. It could be other people participating in the debate. But don't suppress the idea and the necessity for a rational argument when so many people's lives are in the balance. That's all.
Okay,
is that reasonable?
I don't think I have to say, we need a larger discussion at some point about whether or not you're right about whether or not there's a suppression of that discussion or debate, but it's on the table.
Okay.
Now, we show two clarifications, by the way, for those based on some email we got. One, Gene was not here last Monday. A number of people thought he was not here last Monday because he didn't want to deal with this. In fact, weeks before, he had said he was going to be on vacation last week. It was not as he was, and that was prearranged.
So did people actually accuse me of that?
A couple of people did, Gene. God, but I'm just trying to clarify and actually, you addressed the other issue about, we have, on many an occasion prior to the show, when we've been talking to Gene about the subject matter, he has made clear that he is not here to talk for the black community as if it's some monolith. And I'm actually glad you said what you said there. In any case, I've
never represented myself that way.
You know what you need, Gene?
What?
Need a Twitter account. You really do need. I'm serious.
No, I'm going to do
really
it.
You really do need a Twitter account.
Okay, and one other thing I want to say.
Yeah. Please.
I am going to push against the profound anti-intellectualism within the black community that suggests that a dissident voice that challenges the orthodoxy is illegitimate. That's irrational. And I want to push back. I'll take all the criticisms and all the inappropriate, not quite exact historical analogies of former trans. I'll take that. I'll own it. But I must insist that the anti-intellectualism that permeates our community such that any debate or dissenting opinion is suppressed as an illegitimate view, right or wrong, has to be resisted.
But we should be clear, just since you brought that up, Adrian Walker's criticism of you was not because of any illegitimate point of view.
It was purely about your...
Oh, I get it. No, good.
Gene Rivers, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
See you.
We
have been speaking with the Reverend Eugene Rivers III. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with State Treasurer Stephen Grossman, who's running for governor on the Democratic side. We'll talk to him about that run. When we come back, we've got hundreds and hundreds of TV channels, millions of websites, blogs, Twitter, and Facebook, but if the information age democratized news, it's also made us more polarized. We look at what hyperpartisanship means during a crisis like the government shutdown. Up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Do we have
an American story? They're listening in China.
The fact that the government has shut down and the American society has not collapsed is sort of proof to them that the American system is strong and robust.
They're listening in France.
Well, this is pretty bad, actually. You know, all these dysfunctioning elements coming together to have this shut down.
Listen to the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Welch and Forbes, celebrating 175 years of serving as wealth advisors to New England families. Welch and Forbes, knowing wealth, knowing you. On the web at welchforbes.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Mardrigan. The Boston Globe's Michael Cranish wrote this weekend about our highly polarized media. Obviously, people know we're in the golden age of information. Blogs, Twitter, Facebook, hundreds of TV channels, and even some print publications are still around. More and more of this, though, comes from ideologically driven media. In fact, there's a new study out of Duke. It says we're at historic levels of political polarization, the biggest divide since the 1900s. So we want to hear from you on this. Does the media deserve a significant part of the blame for the polarization and gridlock and lack of civility in American politics? Are you part of the problem, getting much of your news from one of these one-sided ventures? Or do you feel that there are enough choices that people can make informed ones and that this is just a mindless blame the media kind of thing? 877-301-8970. I thought Cranish in this piece nailed it. It wasn't like it was news to me, but he nailed it. There's so many egregious examples. You know, he opens up with Alan West is the former Tea Party. And by the way, he criticizes the left and the right, so don't get anxious regardless of your political persuasion. He opens his piece talking about former U.S. Congressman Alan West, who was a Tea Party darling from Florida. The Florida Republican was on Fox News Channel to discuss his astonishing claim. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder was, quote, a bigger threat to our republic than the leader of Al-Qaeda and was guilty of treason from within. Now, that's one side. Here's Ed Schultz, who used to have a regular show on MSNBC. Let's play the second bite of Schultz here. And I think he's on the weekends. I'm not sure. And he's got a national radio show. Here is Ed Schultz from MSNBC.
How could they be so happy that people now aren't getting checks? Michelle Bachmann just attempted and admitted that Republicans are happy about the shutdown. Republicans are happy 800,000 people are out of work. And critical factions of the government are not running. It is unbelievable. I thought Michelle Bachmann was a Christian.
I thought he was okay until he had to throw in that final piece there. I think it is obvious, and I think it is so – this gridlock is so driven by the press that it is staggering. And he makes the obvious point is you hear somebody – you may watch C-SPAN, you may watch the news. And by the way, the number of Americans who are watching news, both cable news and broadcast news combined, is – what does he say? Roughly one-third of it was a couple of decades ago.
That the places that are stealing are ESPN and HBO to a large degree, too.
The moderates who were turned off by extremes on both sides.
You know, that's why I've listened to CNN for a long time, because I can't stand either MSNBC or Fox News, because the exaggeration on both sides just drives you absolutely crazy. And yet CNN is doing worse of the three of them. Now, MSNBC's ratings are apparently down from where they were in the election, where people were tuning into them.
Because they were more juiced about the Obama versus Romney
thing. You know, there was a very interesting disclosure in this Michael Cranch piece about how when the networks dominated, one of the reasons it was much more mainstream was because they were worried about getting the advertisers that were not going to be offensive to anybody. And so now that when you have this little segmented group of viewership, it changes and you can tune in and you may have ads on Fox or ads on MSNBC that are right up your political alley as well. But that wasn't true when everybody wanted to buy Tide or something on the Walter Cronkite.
And it's also, you know, Bob Thompson, who's with us pretty regularly, he's the director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at Syracuse, says to the to Cranish in the Boston Globe, it's in the best interest of these places that partisanship keeps strong and powerful and acidic and toxic because it's more dramatic. And then Cranish goes on to say, in the era of shoutfest, Twitter flames, and comment wars, the danger, in other words, is that the measured voice that leads to compromise has all been drowned out. 877-301-8970. What part of the blame for the mess we're in? I don't just mean the shutdown. I don't just mean the debt ceiling crisis that's, you know, what, X number of 10 days away, I think it is roughly. I mean the whole political environment, which is a word that Emily hates, toxic.
And you know what else? I mean, people know this, but just to add to it, that when you're having a discussion on one of these shows, they want the for and the against, so it can be sort of a back and forth kind of thing. There was a great anecdote about Mickey Edwards, who was a former Republican congressman, going on some show. He wouldn't name what show it was. Yes, and he went on there to criticize some of the extremists in his own party. And he said the interview became very hostile. And after the show was over, he said to the host, the unnamed host, you know, I had to talk about that because it's a reality or something like that. And the host says, come on, Mickey, it's all entertainment. To which the former congressman says, well, people don't think it's entertainment. They think it's real news. And that's really a good distinction, too. I mean, you don't tune into these stations thinking they're making stuff up, but sometimes they're making stuff up.
877-301-8970. You're looking at me like, Jim, they really are making things up. Do you know that, right?
Well, you know,
yes, I do,
the much maligned newspapers that are going out of business, I mean, there is a perspective on the editorial page, but the best newspapers, you're not making stuff up. I mean, it is sort of a fact-based world, and I think some of the cable stations sort of taken leave of that fact-based
world. Well, other problem is they make the point, he makes the point wonderfully, and again, I think most of us realize there's a lot of young people are not getting the news from anybody. Forget the middle-aged people who are now the moderates tuning to ESPN or whatever it is young people are watching Jon Stewart and or Colbert, and while
they're
brilliant.
Lucky for the Democrats.
Well, that's right, but yeah, that is true. Most of those shows are clearly liberal-leaning, but they're not straight news. They're a wonderful explanation of the news, but they're not straight news.
Oh, Schultz is apparently on every night, according to Scott.
No, I don't think so. I thought his show was canceled. Oh, he may have been moved to 5 o'clock. I'm actually working at 5 o'clock. So
In any case,
maybe he is. My apologies for that mistake. Charlie, you're in West Newbury. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I showed you what I know.
Well, we say it all the time, too.
Okay.
Go ahead, Charlie.
I'm an independent. And I listen to all types of talk, and I read both papers, and, you know, Wall Street included, too. And my problem with the media is this. The job of the press is to report and keep the government honest. And that's really their job. And the editorial page is where they can spout their views. And that's the problem. A lot of the papers don't do that, and a lot of media doesn't do that now. And people from the media, from the papers, become anchors on the stations, and their bias is obvious then. So that's the problem that I see.
Well, you know, I have to say, though, a lot of newspaper reporters are very careful about the dividing line. For example, perfect example, Brian McGrory, when he was a columnist, used to be on our old show, was one of the most opinionated humans I'd ever met. Now that he's the editor of the Boston Globe, he's pretty meticulous about not wading into things. But there are some exceptions to those rules on MSNBC and Fox. Charlie, thank you for the call. And the problem is, it's not because people are stupid. It's because they're busy. And running from thing to thing, a huge percentage of Americans accept opinion as fact because that's how it's presented.
Look how careful John King is from CNN, who's on with us
that
every Tuesday at noontime.
That's a great
he
point.
He is very careful about putting this. This is what the Democrats say. This is what the Republicans
he
say.
He often chides himself, by the way, on our show when he thinks he may have come far too close to the line of opinion. He is really careful. You're absolutely right.
Let's go to Mike from Douglas. What do you think, Mike?
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
I absolutely think that the media shares a responsibility because, I mean, isn't the whole point of journalism to present an unbiased, opinion or source of information? And at what point did that start to change so drastically?
Well, by the way, it is fine to present opinion as long as you're presenting as an opinion, as long as you're making clear this is how I view it. And making clear what is fact and what is your approach to fact, it's fine. The problem is that they've become one in many parts of the world. That's where the trouble starts, Mike.
Right, and I don't think enough people, I'm in my 20s, I don't think enough people really question what they hear, and I feel like it's our responsibility as individuals to really diversify our sources of information
Amen.
To be able to really make up our own opinion.
So 20-something Mike, where do you get your news?
I get it from WGBH.
Great.
If I'm watching the TV, I flip between CNN and Fox to kind of look at both sides back and forth, especially with the shutdown. I've kind of been flipping back and forth.
By the way, if you're there's a great, great show on NECN, New England Cable News, at 6 o'clock every night. I love the guy. I can't think of his name, but he is really an impressive news teller. Hey, Mike, thank you. Thank you for your call.
Let's go to Barney from Providence. Hi, Barney.
Hi. One quick comment. Before you go off on newspapers don't lie, I seem to recall a couple of reporters from some of the major Boston papers being fired for lying. So newspapers aren't up on some, holy high horse that they do no wrong. They're better journalists.
They were columnists.
But it's also, they're the outlier. Barney, they are the outliers. The vast majority of people, I think, in this town and in most other responsible newspapers tell the story. And when they launch into opinion, it's identified as such. So yeah, you're right, but they're not the norm. Barney, thank you for the call. It is the broadcast. The numbers are amazing. I was under the naive assumption that a huge percentage of those who used to watch broadcast news had switched to cable news, but in fact, relatively small numbers have switched to cable news, and a huge percentage, well more than 50% of it, according to Cranish's piece. Correct me if I'm wrong, Marjorie. Have moved on other ventures, whether it's Colbert or whether it's as you say, ESPN, those sort of things.
HBO.
People are HBO.
Huge.
They're not even watching. By the way, I'm a news consumer, and I do get my news like that guy's from GBH and those kind of places, and I watch a lot of CNN. But it is true that HBO has captured a lot of my attention, too. And I'm not someone who is uninterested in what's going on in the world. It's sort of embarrassing. 877-301-8970. Let's take a couple of more. Dave, you're on the road. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Dave.
Thanks for taking my call. Good afternoon, guys.
And to you.
I've been waiting for you to bring this issue up.
Well, now's your time,
Dave. Tom Friedman wrote an editorial a week ago in the New York Times, Sunday Times, saying, mm-hmm. The Tea Party was holding the country hostage and for the president to stand tall in the issue. There are three things that are happening. One, you've got gerrymandering to the nth degree.
Marjorie's talked about that every day, yep.
You've got money. The Citizens United, $15 million Sheldon Adelson put up for Newt Gingrich to run for president when no one was voting for him. Kept him pushing issues but nothing else. And then lastly, you've got the media where you can sit down and listen to something that agrees with you. You don't have to listen to anything that's different. And by God, I'm right. See, all of these people are agreeing with me. For example, if you watch Fox News, they mention Obama. They can't say Obama name without saying something bad about it.
No, it's true.
Racism, but it's not just political. There's latent racism there, and I'm an average white guy that's over seven, or close to 70 years old, but I see it, I feel it, and I'm sickened by it. But that's the problem.
Well, Dave, thanks for the call. By the way, I would agree some of it is race-based. I think some of it is ideologically based. Can I cite the statistics? Because I've been quoting them, and I haven't been, in a grand way, I've been right. 52 million Americans watched the three-evening network news broadcast. This is the Cranish piece in the Globe yesterday in 1980. 22 million today. So you'd think, well, where'd those 30 million go? Well, only 2.3 went to Fox, 702,000 to CNN, individual shows they're talking about, primetime shows, and only 811. So far more than half of those 52 million have gone away from news altogether, Marguerite.
And you know, Glenn Beck, who I always thought was kind of a strange guy, you know, he's the one that said Obama had a deep-seated hatred for white people. He was on Fox. Now he runs this online show and oversees an empire worth $75 million. So Glenn Beck is doing very well. I always kind of thought one of these days when you saw him, his head was going to explode on the air. But he's gone on to, in an online show, really reap the rewards.
You know, by the way, since we were trying to be even-handed here and we played an Ed Schultz bite, we should play one from Bill O'Reilly. Here's incidentally, O'Reilly, to his credit. Unlike a lot of
He's much better.
O'Reilly has people who don't agree with him on. He may eviscerate them, but at least they have an opportunity to have their point of view, and I admire him for that. That's the way it should be. Here he is calling Senator Harry Reid a cold-hearted fanatic and accuses him of being indifferent to the suffering of Americans and power-hungry, too.
Senator Reid revealed himself in that exchange to be a cold-hearted fanatic, a man who couldn't care less about compromise or the suffering of Americans. For Harry, it's all about power. We got your number, man.
Cold-hearted fanatic.
Well, actually, he did say on his Fox program, according to this Cranish piece, that there is fanaticism on the right also harming the country. No way Obamacare is going to be defunded. It's not going to happen.
Who said this?
O'Reilly.
Oh, good for him.
On his show. So, and by the way, we have a couple of emails from people that saying that Tim Russert was a master of staying neutral. We lost a lot of integrity in journalism when we lost him. That's from Julie. And Christopher thinks that George Stephanopoulos, even though he did work for Bill Clinton, is reasonably fair.
I think he's reasonably fair, too,
more
actually.
Fair than David Gregory.
Well, you know, obviously all these people have a point of view, and conservative media loves to do these surveys that show that 80% of the media has voted for Barack Obama or for liberal Democrats. The issue is not who they vote for. The issue is how do they behave in the performance of their duties. And if they're fair and down the middle, then I don't really care who they voted for.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to talk about something I can't wait to talk about. Birding with expert Vern Locks. This is the prime birding migration season. Right now, we're going to hear all about birding up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
In an increasingly competitive academic landscape, some women's colleges continue to thrive, while others are struggling to fill their seats.
97% of the young women do not want a single-sex institution.
I think there's a lot to be lost because you lose that sense of empowerment.
I'm on-campus reporter Kirk Carapezzo with that story this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Northeastern University, where researchers are creating interactive tools from apps to avatars to help us make healthier choices. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And Cambridge Savings Bank, a proud member of the community for over 175 years, providing a full range of financial products for individuals, families, and businesses. Because legacy matters. CambridgeSavingsBank.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Now for something completely different. As someone once said, for the uninitiated, this happens to be a great time for birding. Here with us in Studio 3 to explain why that is and what airborne delights await the avid or even the casual birder is Vern Loggs. Vern is the senior naturalist for the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket, writes a weekly birding column for the Cape Cod Times, and you can hear him regularly on our sister station, WCAI, down in the Cape and Islands, where he talks about birding with a good friend of ours, radio host Mindy Todd. Vern, it's a pleasure to meet you in person.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Just hearing that introduction, Vern, has calmed me down tremendously.
He's got me laughing. I'm a senior naturalist. I feel so old.
Well, naturalist, though. I mean, the whole thing and writing a birding column and being down in Nantucket. So why is this the best season for watching migrating birds?
If you just think, birds breed in the spring and the summer. So the populations are at an all-time high. Right now you've had robins maybe took off, they had three or four clutches. So all of a sudden where there were two robins, there's now 22 robins. The land birds, if you think, I love the coast of New England. Cape Cod and the islands are particularly just blessed for their geographic location because most of the birds migrate at night. They're nocturnal migrants. So when you have a northwest wind, if you think about, I live on Nantucket now, so I'm a little biased to Nantucket. Nantucket is way out, it's 30 miles out to sea. And everything, if you think of the land mass, everything is to the north and west of Nantucket.
Mm-hmm.
So a bird that's departing southern Canada, Quebec, or the woods in Vermont, right at sunset, they take off. They get up on a northwest wind. So they're flying about 35 miles an hour. They have a 20-knot tailwind. Their ground speed is 55 miles an hour. As the light comes up, and most of these are young birds, some of them have gone too far out over the ocean. And they turn and they say, oh, my God, it's very scary if you're a little bird. There's nothing but water down there because there's birds trying to eat you, falcons. There's no place to land. There's no place to eat. They turn and they head back to the west. So places like the western tip of Nantucket at Smith's Point, the Gayhead Cliffs in Aquinnah at the west end of the Vineyard, Block Island, Cape May, New Jersey, even Plum Island north on the North Shore is a really good land bird trap.
So they see the land from way up in the sky and head straight for it.
Well, they come down. It's why Central Park in the spring, all the birds are moving over a broad front. So they're spread out, say, over pretty much evenly as they're going north. As the light comes up, if you look down over Metro New York, it's a nightmare if you're a little bird. It's a concrete jungle. And so
it's pretty tough when you live there, too. Yeah. I did that for 15 years, just so you're clear, on the ground.
I go visit. I think it's tough.
Hey, Vern, you paint a beautiful picture, by the way, as someone who has not seen it. So you are the real deal. As we know, you write about it, you lecture about it, you're in the center of this thing. Marjorie and I, at best, are casual observers.
Casual
is there a place?
Observers.
Well, we're not even casual. I mean, it's something you look at
I
it
know,
and it's
blue
pretty.
Jays. Well,
okay,
that's about
fine.
It.
I know
and robins and pigeons.
But is there what's the word I'm looking for? Do people like you look down their noses at? Because you write very accessible stuff, by the way, I should say. I've read a lot of it
yes,
lately.
Yes, terrific.
But are we seen as sort of like second class? Or is there a place for us in that
you're
world?
You're my audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, the bird watchers, the people that are already interested, are going to read the stuff and follow it anyway.
Right.
But whenever I write anything, I say, why would I read this stuff? Why is that important? It doesn't matter what I know. It's how you can share it. Why is this exciting? How can you get someone to be interested in birds?
So now that I know that you're not going to demean us, I can ask the question that I was almost too embarrassed to ask. I read about the migrations in a couple of recent pieces you wrote, which are great. Are there birds which don't migrate in winter that actually stay around here?
There's a lot of birds that don't migrate.
Like what? How do they exist? What do they eat?
Like black-capped chickadees, which, the state bird of Massachusetts and Maine? It's the black-capped chickadee.
I did not know
How
that.
Do they determine the state birds? They asked all the fourth graders what their favorite bird was. And it's a very scientific. That's true. That's how Massachusetts got the name. It's really amazing for birds. There's a bird called a golden crown kinglet. It's our smallest bird after hummingbirds. I mean, these things weigh 8 or 9 grams.
Oh, my God.
There's 28 grams in an ounce. And so just one of these little water bottles.
A third of an ounce?
They're impossibly small. Their feathers weigh 3.5 grams. So there's really only 5 grams of bird there. And they are able to make it in the winter here, eating. It's really unbelievable that they can do it. Their body temperature is 106 degrees. They are living so fast, we don't even exist. We're like Galapagos tortoise for these little birds.
So where do they live in the winter? In their little nests?
No, they don't. The only nest they nest at the breeding season. At night, they go to roost. And generally, around here, the kinglets will roost in a very dense spruce or pine grove. They go huddle right into the middle. Some birds, woodpeckers, like to nest in holes at night.
Yep.
Some birds actually pig pile, like eastern bluebirds will go in. If it gets really cold, they'll fly into a box, and like six or eight more, they just pig pile in there and stay warm all night. They come out in the morning. I always wondered about what the one on the bottom. You know.
So should we leave out bird feeders for our bird friends or not?
I want to invite you both right now to come birding with me sometime. Either on, it doesn't have to be Nantucket. I go birding in a lot of places.
And so what does that mean? What do I do? Mindy, do I come out with binoculars?
A big birder. So that's a great question. What do we do?
Yeah, you come out with your binoculars and your
you don't need anything except binoculars are really important because. Yeah. It's, you know, if you see, like, you're looking out the window and all of a sudden you're eight times closer because you magnify it. Yep. And you can actually see the details on the bird. You can see what its bill looks like. You can see if it has wing bars. You need binoculars and you need a birding book.
Okay.
And there's a lot of different field guides around. Everybody has their own favorites. I, of course, I think own every field guide that's ever been made.
What are one or two that you would recommend?
I like
to
the National Geographic Guide to birds. I like, I mean, this... We've got an author and an artist living out in Concord, Mass., David Sibley. His books are very well received. The Sibley Guides. There's a lot. I like the Peterson Field Guide. Still my absolute favorite, I think.
So, Vernon Lux, let's assume we want to stay in the mainland. We'd like to visit you on Nantucket, but we can't in the immediate future. And I know it's key migratory season, if that's the proper terminology. Where would I go this weekend to get to see a great assemblage of migrating birds?
More people from greater Boston and even from New England probably go birding. They do go birding up in Newburyport and to Plum Island National Wildlife Refuge. It's called Parker River National Wildlife Refuge. And guess what? It's all locked up. It's shut down because of the government.
Because the federal...
Yeah, the bird watchers are really upset.
Oh,
Concord Great Meadows out in Concord. Can't go there. It's all locked. I mean, I guess you could hike down the island, but... So that's really Plum Island is really impacting a lot of birds. They're very unhappy. If you go onto like massbird.org, which is people report their sightings, it's like they're all like, "Geez, when is that government going to get it together?"
We're saying the same thing.
Yeah, I know. Was,
where do birds go in hurricanes?
Birds are they're able to feel the low pressure coming, and all these, especially the migratory species, they've dealt with hurricanes their entire since that species started going, and they're able to usually, some of them can duck out of the way. They feel it coming. But a hurricane starts, you know, it's coming off the coast of Africa. The seabirds that are out there feel the low pressure and the big winds, and they stay on the outer bands. Of the hurricane. And they can be transported many thousands of miles from where they want to be.
Wow.
And a lot of times when they go up into the Gulf Coast, reservoirs in the middle of the country will pick up these pelagic birds that are obviously not going to make it, that were actually storm driven in. So they can be devastating for them.
But how about right here in Massachusetts? Like, where do the little chickadees go?
Well, what do they do in a snowstorm, any storm?
I don't know.
They run for cover. They stay. Woodpeckers are like amazing in the winter. They don't like bad weather, and they like to sleep in late. I've had woodpeckers in different boxes for years that I watch. You know, and they come in late afternoon. Hang out. They sleep. Then if it's nasty out, snowing, they're just going to stay in the box all day.
It's my kind of bird.
So have you made a living being a bird watcher?
Yes and no. I have two grown kids. Fortunately, when I was getting them through college, the birding. I used to lead birding tours all over the world. I've been on all seven continents.
Wow.
I was the American expert on the birds of the Middle East for a while. I've been to Antarctica 40 times. I spent five seasons as the bird expert on board, and I was head of the Zodiacs. And so I, you know, one year I went 12 times.
Wow!
I was so sick of that boat.
So where does that come from? Where did Vernon Lux birder begin? How did it start?
I had a science teacher. I grew up in suburban Boston, out here in Wellesley. And when I was in the eighth grade, I was 12. I had a teacher. I got a gentleman named Doug Sands, who, when you walked into the classroom, this is the eighth grade, and they had started Metco, they were busing students, and it was a very diverse classroom. I'll never forget walking in the first time, and all the desks are all screwed up and knocked to the side. And there in the room is this giant Galapagos tortoise walking around named Albie. Oh, and we could feed a lettuce. He was in World War II. He was very old when I had him. I was like the last year. And he was stationed in the meteorological – he was in the meteorological service, that's easy for me to say, in the Galapagos Islands. And all he brought back from the war, which, of course, you couldn't – he brought a tortoise back in his bag. and it was still alive in the classroom. And it, right, you just knew it was going to be a different class.
So have you got any hero bird stories or anything that we should know about?
A hero bird
story? Well, I mean, just great bird stories. It kind of, when you go to a cocktail party, meet somebody new, you say, wait till I tell you this story about my birding life.
Well, it's funny. Well, I don't have any great – there's too many stories to go on. But, I mean, my biggest worry, especially birding in urban areas, is finding bodies. Because you go to places that nobody goes in cities. And one time I was doing a Christmas count on Buzzards Bay on the Cape, and we're out looking with a spotting scope, and there's a rare bird. There's a razorbill, a type of auk. It's an alcid, like a little penguin almost, diving up and down out in the – and then we're looking at the – what's it diving by? It was a body. Somebody had jumped off.
Human being?
Yeah, we had to call the police. And so that was kind of –
I thought you meant bird bodies. You know,
it was somebody – it was a jumper.
Oh, my God.
It's not funny at all, but
– you know, Vern, I just called him Bird. Vern, we want to ask you a question about this in a second, about the third Nantucket Birding Festival, which I know is later this month.
It's in 10 days or
17th
so.
To the 20th. And yeah. Whether or not mere mortals could learn from that.
We're very excited.
But you wrote a piece. One of the pieces I read of yours recently was talking about how the beauty of these birding festivals, a lot of experts come, a lot of great birders come, and occasionally they identify a bird that others have not. What was the last time? When was the last setting where you saw a bird that you had never seen before? What was that like for someone like you?
The last bird like that I saw was the gray-tailed tattler, which is a tiny little shorebird that breeds in Siberia on these little rocky streams. They're rare even there, and then they winter way down in the South Pacific, all over in China. They're even quite rare there.
When was this and where was this?
The last year on the first day of the birding festival, we start on a Thursday night with a dinner. Of course, my leaders get there, and a lot of these guys are just charged up. They're amped up and ready to go. So they let them borrow a couple of cars, and they're out birding. And just before dark, they found this bird and had it fly off. They recorded it, and they said it was a gray-tailed tattler. There'd only been two gray-tailed tattlers ever seen in the continental U.S. before. One was in Washington State, one was in Oregon. So to get one on the eastern seaboard, it was just totally out of control. In fact, that festival turned into the Great Tattler Hunt. Because the thing, it never stayed in the same place. It flew off, and we never would have hunted it. We basically sent, you know, I had an army of people looking for it. And fortunately, we were able to relocate it five different times. It never stayed put. And the last Saturday afternoon, it finally came in. Everybody got to see it. We got pictures, and then it disappeared. So the only people that got to see the tattler were the people that were at the birding festival.
Are there parts of the world that are better for bird watching than others? I mean, is the United States better or worse, or is you know, Africa the bird capital of the world?
The peak of diversity is near the equator.
Near the equator.
South America has far and away the most birds. Ecuador, tiny little country the size of Colorado.
Yeah.
1,700 species of birds.
Wow.
All of North America, north of the Mexican border, all of the U.S., including Canada, Alaska. If you really work hard at it, 700 species in a lifetime.
Plus that tattler, so it's 701.
That's
seconds left, and I want to hear, how do people find out about the Nantucket Birding Festival? How do they get there? What's the deal?
It's the best little birding festival in North America. We have a website called www.llnf.org. That's the initials for the Linda Loring Nature Foundation, who sponsor this.
LLNF.org.
LLNF, Lima, November, Foxtrot.org.
I like that.
And then click on the calendar. It says there's Birding Festival link, and it'll give you all the details, the schedule, and we still have room, and we'd love to see you down in Nantucket.
When are you taking us birding?
I don't know. When are you free?
I think we could be soon.
I'm into this.
Actually,
I was so excited. It was so much fun to talk to you, Vern Lox.
It's great to
meet
you,
so much for coming in. Vern Lox is the senior naturalist for the Linda Loring Nature Foundation. Sorry, Vern. On Nantucket, writes a weekly birding column in the Cape Cod Times, and he's a regular on our sister station on the Cape and the Islands. And don't forget the third Nantucket Birding Festival is from the 17th to the 20th of October.
LLNF.org. I memorized. Is that correct, Vern?
Yeah. That's it.
Nicely done, Jim.
Nantucket Birding Festival. Thanks, you guys, for another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Ask the Mayor with Tom Menino. We're also going to be talking to the gubernatorial candidate, State Treasurer Stephen Grossman. Our show is a production of WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy. Follow me at Jim Browdy. Follow the show at BOS Public Radio. And follow Marjorie Egan at Marjorie Egan. We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye.